Information is available at 367-0300.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. This hour of the program comes from the Focus 580 Archives, a show that was first broadcast in April. So as you listen, do keep in mind that in this hour, we will not take calls. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about Syria, its internal politics, its place in the politics in the Middle East, and its relationship with the United States. And our guest for the program is David Lesh. He is professor of Middle East history at Trinity University, which is in San Antonio, Texas. And he's the author of a book that was published last fall titled The New Lion of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. It's published by the Yale University Press. For many, many years, in fact, for 30 years, Syria was ruled by Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad. He took over in a coup in November of 1970. He had been the Minister of Defense. He died in the year 2000 after being in power for 30 years. While he was still alive, he had been preparing one of his sons to take over when he was gone. However, that all changed when that son in the 90s was killed in a car accident. And so Bashar became the heir apparent. He was someone who had never been intended to be the president, had been living in London, working as an ophthalmologist, and found himself going from that to being the president of a country. It's an experience for which he was never prepared. People in Syria thought that perhaps when he became president, things would be different. I think that a lot of people are disappointed, and yet it remains to be seen ultimately what will happen in Syria, and as a result of this man who had never been intended to be president becoming the leader of the country. David Lesh had an unusual opportunity to talk with Bashar al-Assad to do this book, and we'll talk a little bit about how that came about in this first hour of the show. Professor Lesh, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, my pleasure to be here.
Just first to talk about how this book came about, you explained in the introduction that you were interested in, obviously this is something that you had been writing about and following for some time, politics right. of Syria and the region, and thought that this would be an interesting opportunity to do something at a point, a very significant point of change for the country, and that you happened to have a contact, somebody that you could ask, on the chance that Bashar al-Assad would actually sit down and talk with you. And I don't know if you actually thought that would be possible, but figured, well, nothing ventured. Were you in fact surprised when the word came back that he would talk to you?
Well, I think it's more in the latter. Yeah, nothing ventured, nothing gained. I mean, the contacts I developed in Syria over the years basically just happened to have grown up with Bashar or knew him in the Syrian Computer Society, of which Bashar was chairman when he returned from London in the 1990s after his brother died. And I just had this intellectual curiosity about him because he was such an enigma, and as you mentioned in your summary, he had such a non-traditional path to the presidency. It wasn't earmarked for this, and the expectations about him were so high, especially because he was perceived to be this modernizing computer nerd, westernizer, who was widely reported to have liked Phil Collins music. In fact, the first time I met Bashar, I said to him, you know, the worst thing that ever happened to you is that it was widely reported that you liked Phil Collins music, because it lifted all of these, or it created all these expectations that he would embrace the West and make peace with Israel, and was not a really realistic assessment of his position, especially considering, you know, the dilapidated state of the country he inherited from his father. So it was really just intellectual curiosity about all of this stuff. And I approached my friend, who was a friend of his and in the government at the time in a fairly high position, in 2002. And he said he liked the idea and would bring it to Bashar's attention. And about 2 years later to the day, I heard from the Syrian ambassador to the United States, and he said, it's a go. And by that time, I said, what's a go? and he said that Bashar would like to see you and so forth. And so that's how it came on board. And I've met with him a number of times in May, June 2004. I met with him again in May 2005 after Syrian troops withdrew from Lebanon, and I met with him again a couple of months ago in February, and have maintained email contact with him as well.
I think that you again explained that you explained to the reader and also explained that you had told the Syrians that you were interested in doing something straight, honest, that you, right. you weren't about to certainly it wasn't intention to do some kind of unvarnished look at Bashar al-Assad and at Syria. Why do you think he decided that he wanted to talk to you?
Well, in fact, again, that first meeting, I sat down with him, and I told him, I said, Mr. President, you know I'm not an apologist for Syria. And he goes, I know that, because I've read some of your writings, and they were very critical of Syria, especially under my father, under Hafez al-Assad. And, but he realized that I, you know, try to take an objective viewpoint, and I give Syria, I think, a fair shake on things and try to see things from their perspective. I think the change occurred in his attitude because of the Iraq War that began in March, April 2003, when relations between the United States and Syria began to deteriorate because the U.S. was accusing Syria of supporting Iraqi insurgents. And so I think you know, by early 2004, when his people contacted me, he thought it was probably advantageous to present a different view of him, and you know, this was his own sort of limited public diplomacy, although I think he thought, and the Syrians think, it was a big, big step in doing this type of thing and allowing this type of access.
Well, let's begin by talking a little bit about the family, and particularly about the father and the two sons. Mm-hmm. Was it the expectation from the point that they were little boys that, in fact, Basil was going to be the man who would succeed the father?
Right. I think not when they were boys. It was they tried to be as apolitical as possible. One of the things that really struck me about this family, that it was as normal a family as you can be when the father is the president of the country. I mean, this is the total opposite of Qusay and Uday Hussein, the sons of Saddam Hussein, and how privileged and they were, and just as deranged in many ways. This was a very normal family. They went to they went to classes every day. They didn't get privileged treatment. They weren't chauffeured to their classes. They received bad grades, which means that the teachers were not intimidated to give them good grades. So it was a very normal type of family, and you can't help but be somewhat politicized when you're the sons of a president of the country. But they did not have this. They were not on this political track from the very beginning, and I think things changed in the early 1980s from Hafez al-Assad's point of view, the father, when there was a coup attempt against him in 1983, when he was also very ill by his brother, of all people, Rifat al-Assad. And I think that perforce compelled the father to really close his inner circle and probably rely more on his first son, Basil, to possibly succeed him. And it's at that time that Basil starts to play an increasing role in the government and at his father's side. And so he was earmarked, as you said, by certainly the late 80s, early 90s. It was pretty clear, as Hafez al-Assad's health became a question, that he was being groomed for a succession. However, again, as you mentioned, Bashar had no inkling that he was going to be in this position throughout much of the 1990s. Only when he returned, I think, did he start to... And there's a big divergence in this. Bashar says he was never, and all his acolytes say that he was never being groomed, whereas everyone else in the world can clearly see that in some ways he was being groomed. It might just be a matter of semantics, but there seems to be a divergence in that view.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was, at the time that his father died, he wasn't even living in Syria.
Right. He was studying ophthalmology in London, basically getting what is the equivalent of board certification for ophthalmology. He was already an ophthalmologist and doing surgery in Syria, so not exactly the path toward a political career or being president. He came back, according to what he says, he came back because now he was the elder son. And that is very important in an Arab family, that the elder son come back and take many matters of the family in hand and so forth. But he insists that he was never being groomed and that he didn't even know he was going to be president until his father died, which I don't quite believe. I think he had to have some inkling of this, at least, and I think most believe that to be the case. But whatever the matter is, whatever the story is, he did become president. Mm-hmm.
Well, at the point where Basil died, mm-hmm. and the man who had been considered to be the heir apparent, mm-hmm. was, you would think that would be a potential point for conflict. At least at that point, the father was still there, but you would think that other people there would think, well, this is my opportunity. Was that a point where there was jockeying for political position?
There was never anything that I saw or was reported about jockeying for position after Basil died. I mean, that would be, as you mentioned, a point where that could happen, but everything I've read and heard suggests that that did not happen, and it also suggests that Hafez was indeed in control of the government and could basically handpick who he wanted to succeed him at that time. Now, this would not have been the case perhaps 4 or 5 years later when Hafez's health started to deteriorate more and perhaps his control over the regime was not as omnipresent as it was in the early to mid-90s.
Mm-hmm. What the car accident that killed Basil was in 1994,
yeah.
And then Hafez al-Assad died in 2000. So here we have a 6-year period where Bashar has got to gear up. Anything he's going to do to get ready, this is the time that he is getting ready to become
right. The
next president. What did he do, or what was done with him to try to take him from the point where he had no experience working in government before, and none of the kind of foundation that maybe you would think would be important for somebody if they were going to become president of the country? What in what ways did he try to prepare?
Well, primarily it was he was re-enrolled basically in the military. He had actually been a military ophthalmologist before he went to London, but this time he took training in various aspects of the military and was fairly quickly elevated, from the equivalent of captain to major to colonel, and finally, brigadier general when he became president. And in this sense, what the father, I think, was trying to do was to one, pad the credentials of Bashar with the security military apparatus in Syria, but also to build up a coterie of loyal followers among the junior officer class in the Syrian army, as well as in the Syrian security apparatus. In the 90s, and I think you're starting to see that come into play now in the last couple of years as Bashar has been weeding out some of the so-called old guard that served under his father, and some of these military officers who he befriended and who were loyal to him in the mid to late 90s are starting to be elevated to positions of authority now.
Hmm. Well, certainly at the point where Hafez al-Assad died, that would have been a point where you would think if there was somebody else who decided that they should be president, this would be the time where you could have had some sort of coup attempt, where if Bashar was perceived at all to be weak, that would have been the point. Was there, as far as you know, any inkling, or how well was the idea of him being president and being the successor, how well was that received, particularly in the military and among the people who were the elites there in Syria?
That was a critical period, and whether Bashar had any inkling or not, I think the military security apparatus certainly had an inkling, and they wanted him to become president. It was actually relatively smooth. According to Syrian law, the vice president, Abdul Halim Khaddam, was supposed to become the interim president, and he really wasn't any talk of that. Bashar was elevated above that, and there was a Ba'ath Party, the ruling party in Syria, Ba'ath Party Congress meeting that was previously scheduled that was held, and they put him forth as the only candidate, and then there was a referendum held in Syria, which is, basically Bashar was the only name on the referendum, and it's a yes-no type of thing. It's really not an election, and he won like 97-98%. Of the vote in the referendum. It was very smoothly handled, and I think at the bottom line is that the military security apparatus, which is dominated by the Alawite Muslim class in Syria, which is a minority schism or sect out of Shiite Islam, which had traditionally held the reins of power and in which the Assads are members as well, they realized that their best chance for maintaining their political economic positions in positions in the military security apparatus was to get Bashar in power. And so this was a maintenance not just of the Assads in power, but maybe more importantly, a maintenance of the Alawite ruling class in power and all the other associated elements, non-Alawite, such as a number of Sunni elements who are tied into that ruling class. And this was the best way to do it. And Bashar had also been a very popular figure in the population even before he became president, because he was given a heightened or increasing profile in the late 1990s, especially a very popular anti-corruption campaign that he headed in the late 1990s, which was in part used as a way to get rid of some of the potential discontents to Bashar coming to power. And that's what his father did, or some of the people supporting him just before he died in the couple of years, is that they, I think they got rid of, or retired, I should say, not got rid of, but retired enough of potential opponents to Bashar to ease the way for him to come into power.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Lesh. He is professor of Middle East history at Trinity University. That's in San Antonio, Texas. Author of a number of books, including one that came out last fall, I believe, entitled The New Lion of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. It's published by the Yale University Press. I suppose that one of the big questions that people ask about Bashar, certainly I expect they asked it early on, and perhaps they're still asking it, is indeed he ruling, or is he a figurehead and the power really rests in the hands of people who are around him, beside him, not out front?
I think that's a very good question, and I think I've seen a definite evolution in his role as president. Early on, I do not think he was ruling as well as reigning. There were a number of elements in the so-called old guard that had certain sinecures of power that were really untouchable even to Bashar. And I think this was one of the problems with the situation in Iraq as well as the situation in Lebanon as it developed over the years. However, he has slowly been able, despite the obstacles internally and the pressure externally, to remove many of these old guard elements or elements that do not support his reformist agenda as well as his foreign policy agenda. And he's brought them into power. When I saw him in February, he was as confident as I've ever seen him, especially with regard to his relationship with the United States, which has deteriorated a great deal. He was very relaxed. I'm not a psychologist, but his verbiage and his body language was that of a very confident president. And the regime is pretty confident right now because they've survived. They think they survived the pressure from the United States due to the UN report revolving around the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri in Lebanon in February 2005, and they feel that the U.S. did not get the support in the U.N. Security Council that they had anticipated. The U.S. is now, you know, focused more on Iran, and there was a cabinet reshuffle in Syria, the days I was there in February, as well as in the military security apparatus a few weeks later, and he really has brought in more of the people that he has wanted to bring in for some time. So this is a very confident regime. Maybe perhaps a little bit overconfident, in my view, and a very confident president. So he's more in power now than he's ever been. And that's, people who were saying he was weak and untested and inexperienced, well, you know, he's a bit more experienced and he has been tested. Whether you like his policies or not, now that he is more confident and in power and in control of things, you have to give him credit for manipulating and maneuvering through these turbulent waters in Syrian politics and getting to where he is now.
Well, we have a caller. Let's talk with them. Someone listening this morning in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Just a couple of things. I'd like for you to talk about why you think that either he or the regime itself is overconfident. And secondly, I'd like for you to give a grade for where he is right now in terms of, you know, how other Arab countries and in the larger picture, Islamic countries, bring their leaders up. It sounded pretty moderate to me and very sensible of what you were saying and stuff. You know, I don't seem to think there was any bloodshed that, you know, in large scale that anybody knows about. I just wondered, you know, if you could, you know, relate to that in some way. Thanks a lot.
Why are they, why the Syrian regime is overconfident? There's some actions that they have taken and some rhetoric they've adopted of late that's not quite Iranian, but it certainly presents a sense of this confidence. I think the burning of the Danish embassy in Damascus, which I think the regime allowed or let get out of hand, maybe is a better way to put it. And I don't think they really understand that they can't really alienate Western Europe. Now, they did that as a bone thrown to the Islamist opposition or Islamist groups in Syria, which are perceived by the regime as something of a threat, and so this was a way for them to vent their frustrations over the publication of those cartoons about Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad. And but you just don't do this. You don't allow the burning of a European embassy like this. And the regime is not really repentant, never offered to compensate. And I think they have to realize that there are still elements in the Bush administration that are focusing on Syria. And if things draw to a standstill with Iran, they could focus their attention on Syria again. And so they can't be too overconfident. They have to maintain at least a certain level of contacts with the United States. And I think they will do that, but I think they also need to watch out that they don't become too overconfident in the future. As far as a grade for the regime, I give it a C right now. I give Bashar a lot of credit for getting to this point and for securing his control, but they still need to do a great deal more in terms of internal reform. And he knows this. I mean, I saw him in February, and he was he's still very, very frustrated of the lack of implementation. I mean, there's all sorts of great ideas on how to try to shift the moribund Syrian state-dominated, public sector-dominated economy to a more market-oriented one. But implementation is the key. As Bashar told me one occasion, I sign hundreds or thousands of decrees, but only a handful are actually implemented. And so he only has so much power when there's such a inertia in the bureaucracy and such a culture of caution as well as corruption in the country. So this is a long-term process. I think he needs to get moving more. It's almost a race to implement this economic reform before there's an economic implosion.
We are on our midpoint here, and again, questions are certainly welcome as we continue our conversation with David Lesh. He is an historian. He's professor of Middle East history at Trinity University. That's in San Antonio in Texas, and is the author of the book The New Lion of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad in Modern Syria, published by the Yale University Press. Let's talk a little bit about the Hariri assassination. Ed, you mentioned that, as you mentioned in, this was February last year, February 2005.
Right. Valentine's Day.
this man was one-time prime minister of Lebanon, Rafik Hariri. He was killed by a car bomb in Lebanon. And I think that there are people in Lebanon almost immediately, and also people elsewhere around the world, said that they thought Syria had something to do with this, right. Whether it was a totally Syrian operation or whether it was some people who were hooked into the Syrian security apparatus involved in sort of parallel people in Lebanon. The whole thing was not particularly clear. But there was a lot of anger in Lebanon directed toward Syria. There were demonstrations against Syria. And actually, as a result, Syria removed its troops from Lebanon, and they'd been there for a long time. What do you think one can say, or what can one say about who was responsible for the assassination of Mr. Hariri?
Well, it's, again, one of these things we may never know. We may never have a smoking gun on exactly who did it, or we may never know if Bashar, gave the order or not. My sense, as I write in the book, is that the Syrian and Lebanese security apparatus did at least have indirect knowledge of it or participated in it, but I don't believe Bashar gave the order, and I have no evidence to back that up except for a gut feeling and my sense of how things work or don't work in Syria. I think Lebanon was one of those sinecures of power that were kind of outside of Bashar's purview, and those elements in the military security apparatus that saw Lebanon as a fiefdom almost, they felt they could act with impunity, and they also felt that Hariri was a threat to them and to their position eventually, and that this was the least worst alternative, and if maybe they could survive it with just a slap in the hand rather than what happened. They misread the environment tremendously, whether Bashar was behind it or not. They misread the environment and the international environment tremendously, which is not unusual for the Syrian regime. They often misread the regional and particularly the international environment, particularly the response of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems a particularly stupid thing to have done, really, when you think about it, to attack someone who was such a well-known figure,
right,
very publicly critical of Syria, someone who was well-respected in Lebanon and elsewhere, to do something, such a dramatic public thing. It doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense.
No, it doesn't. In fact, what really didn't make sense, and what Bashar was responsible for this other policy initiative, which kind of created the environment in which the Hariri assassination occurred, was earlier, about 6, 7, 8 months earlier in 2004, when they used extra-constitutional means to extend the term of office of Lebanese President Amir Lahoud, who was a close ally of Damascus. And that is what originally created an uproar in the international community, particularly allying France and the United States at a time when we were, obviously had a great many differences in foreign policy, especially toward the Middle East and Iraq in specifically. And alienating France was the key to this, and alienating much of the rest of Western Europe when they extended the term of Amir Lahoud, and that really started to build up the pressure on Syria. There was a UN Security Council resolution passed shortly thereafter, and that created the environment in which the opposition became emboldened in Lebanon, including Rafik Hariri. And also when it started to threaten Syria's position, and the elements in Syria, or in Lebanon, may have been behind the assassination. So that was really what initially, started off that chain of events that led to the Hariri assassination.
Mm-hmm. How did the decision to withdraw the Syrian troops from Lebanon, how did that go down in Syria?
Well, in some ways, there weren't mass demonstrations against Bashar. I know there were a lot of prognostications saying that Bashar would never survive this because Lebanon was more important to Syria than the Golan Heights and getting that return. There were some negative feelings certainly in the military security apparatus that benefited economically from their hold on Lebanon. But as a whole, a number of Syrians adopted sort of a nationalistic response that, the Lebanese were ungrateful and that, they understood that that the Syrians couldn't match the power of the UN, the United States, when it's allied against it. And so there was a real nationalistic response against the Lebanese, the ungrateful Lebanese, so to speak, and also the international community. And many Syrians, talking to them personally and just walking and traveling around Syria, they were like, they were kind of upset over the years that it seemed like the regime spent more time and money on Lebanon than they did on Syria. So maybe now they'll spend it on Syria. And Bashar has I think, expertly ridden, he's rode this nationalistic wave in the aftermath of the withdrawal and the pressure from the United States toward more domestic support for his regime and really stirring up stirring up even further this nationalistic response. And this is also why the regime is very confident right now. As he said to me at one time, I'm more popular now in Syria than ever, as well as in the region, because of this pressure. So he kind of jokingly said, I really don't want the U.S. to change its policy because its pressure is actually making me more popular.
Well, let's talk with another caller here. We have someone in Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, it's troubling to me that the interference of the West, and I hope you've not already discussed it, about Syria's intervention in Lebanon when the place was complete and utter chaos, and then Ronald Reagan going back there, and then those Marines being blown into the water, and the interference of the West in Arabic states and around the world. And my view, I think they had taken over the paradigm of the English, who had scuttled the world in the quest for money and booty, and that thing now seems to have been taken over by the U.S., who is, it's troubling that around the world and where there is wealth and power to be obtained, they go in and do whatever they want to, like is happening in Iraq and all the threats in Iran and all this sort of thing. Does your guest have any comment about that and the hegemony that the U.S. seems to take as some birthright that they can go into these places and use military arms, again, like the English, you know, when they scattered through India and on to the Middle East and Africa. Where are we going with this? The westernization of the entire world seems to me to be counterproductive.
Well, that's certainly, I think, the caller reflects the view of many in the Middle East and the Arab world. They see a grave double standard on the part of the United States, and they see, you know, what many in the United States see as altruistic, they see as imperialistic, cultural imperialism, economic imperialism, political imperialism, and that globalization has an American name to it. In fact, even the word democracy is almost seen as Americanization, which makes it difficult, because I think democracy, you know, is a good thing. It should not be imposed. It should evolve indigenously and based on one's own culture and heritage, and these things just don't happen overnight. And so they very much react negatively to anything that's imposed on them. There's a nationalistic response to this, and this is what Bashar, as I said earlier, had been writing, is this nationalist response to this pressure. And that's what's happening in Iraq, too. You know, you have a lot of these groups that are just, it's a convulsive response to oppose anyone who's perceived to be an occupier, no matter how altruistic their goals may be. The caller mentioned, Lebanon. I think that's a good point, is that, and this is why many Syrians view the Lebanese as ungrateful, is that at a time when no one else was particularly interested in stabilizing the chaotic situation in Lebanon, you know, after the Israeli invasion in 1982, the Syrians were the ones, I mean, for their own reasons, obviously, and own interests, and certainly they exploited the situation when they were there, but they were the only ones, and the U.S. allowed it. There was a quid pro quo for Syrian participation in the 1991 Gulf War, the U.S.-led U.N. coalition to evict Iraq from Kuwait. In return, there was kind of a quid pro quo that the U.S. would allow Syria to move back into Lebanon and revive their influence there. And again, they stabilized it, you know, the situation when no one else could or was particularly interested in. And a lot of people tend to forget that many people certainly in the Bush administration, the so-called neoconservatives, they tended to blame Syria for, you know, the U.S. departure from Lebanon and for the blowing up of the Marine barracks that killed 241 Marines in October 1983. And certainly pro-Syrian elements were behind that. But from the Syrian perspective, they were fighting for their life. They saw the U.S. as supporting Israeli interests and doing through the multinational force and through diplomacy what the Israelis couldn't do militarily, and that is basically get control of Lebanon and outflank Damascus, and that was the view from Damascus. So they were fighting for their survival, and they'd fight tooth or nail to do it to survive. And many people forget that this whole environment was brought about by the PLO entrance into Lebanon, the factionalization that was already existed in Lebanon, and ultimately the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982 that created the chaotic environment in which something like the Marine barracks bombing occurred. So, you know, to hold Syria solely responsible for this, I think, is inaccurate.
Am I off?
I don't know what happened there. I'm afraid we'll have to move on. Other questions are welcome, by the way. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As we mentioned, or as you mentioned, I think that there were people in Syria who were very optimistic about what might happen as a result of Bashar succeeding his father. And I think that it is true that he is somewhat more liberal in his political outlook than his father. But at the same time, while he promised when he gave his first speeches, he talked about political and democratic reform, I think that a lot of people in the country have really been disappointed that doesn't really seem to have gone anyplace. After having talked with him and getting some idea about what he's thinking about and what he thinks about where he'd like to take the country, what can one say about the differences between himself and his father, and perhaps what he might like to see happen in terms of change?
Well, I think that's an important question, and I think we're at an important potential tipping point in that regard. You mentioned the title of my book, The New Lion of Damascus. Lion in Arabic is Assad. and that's why, you know, the father was known as the Lion of Damascus. In my original title, I had the New Lion of Damascus question mark, but publishers don't like question marks, so they removed it. But the question still remains: is he the new Lion of Damascus? Is he the new Hafez al-Assad? And basically what I say in my book is that it's not good for Syria if he does turn out to be like his father. And I think we're in an important stage right now. There were a great deal of expectations when he came to power. His inaugural speech had all sorts of nice things regarding economic reform and even political reform. But he inherited, many economic and political problems when he took father. It was a broken-down country, and considering the fact that soon after he came to power, you had the Al-Aqsa Intifada in the occupied territories, you had 9/11, then the U.S. responses in Afghanistan and Iraq, he really hasn't had much time to breathe or implement reform, because as he told me one time, I have to think of staying in power and security first before I think of reform. But now that the regime, I think, has secured itself, he has the people he wants, most of the people he wants in the cabinet and in the military security apparatus and so forth, and they have the feeling that they have survived this onslaught from the United States. I think now people are going to start to say, look, you know, you've had your grace period. You've had more than enough grace period. Now you have to perform. Now you have to deliver the economic goods in particular. And that's really what is going to make or break this regime, is economic reform, including human resource development to provide the skilled workforce and the educational levels that should be improved, and all of these things that contribute to a robust and growing economy. Unfortunately, most of these things are long-term, and I'm not quite sure, and a lot of people aren't quite sure economically, if Syria has that much time to play with, or this regime has that much time to play with. You know, they tend to like the Chinese model of economic reform in terms of a strong central government implementing the type of economic reform necessary to produce positive results. And so they're hoping for that. Whether or not they can do it is a different story.
We are now heading into our last 15 minutes. We have several callers. We'll try to get everybody in, and you can help us by being brief in your comments. Let me again introduce our guest, David Lesh. He's professor of Middle East History at Trinity University in San Antonio, and he is the author of the book, The New Lion of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. It was published last fall by the Yale University Press. Let's go next to Bloomington, Indiana. Next caller in line, and that's line one. Hello.
Hi. When someone like Bashir gives you his time for an audience, don't you have to assume that he's going to try to use you to spread his propaganda? And how do you discern when he's telling you the truth, or when he's simply trying to use you? How do you work that?
No, that's a good question. It's a question, you know, I ask myself on many occasions, and this is one of the problems of doing a biographical sketch of someone who's still alive, that you have to talk to him and also some personal aspects to it. I mean, I like him personally. He's in almost everyone who meets him likes him personally. He's a very unassuming, humble man, and a very smart, gregarious type of guy, a very loyal friend. And so all these things create this impression that you know, you hope doesn't influence your a balanced assessment of where he is, where he's going. I think what helped me to discern, you know, what things were kind of the rote line and what things were honest or true is just doing my homework, asking all sorts of different people in and outside of the regime, just knowing the country as I have. I mean, I've been to the country 10, 12 times, spent a great deal of time there. And, of course, it's been a focus of my research and scholarship for many years. And so I think I have a pretty good sense of what is and what is not true. There are some things, but it's also important in my book, you know, when I was talking about earlier, when he said he wasn't being groomed and that he knew that he didn't know he was going to be president until the day it occurred. You know, I thought that was kind of disingenuous, and there was a reason why he's doing that. And so I felt that it needed to be portrayed in the book. And while I do say I thought it was disingenuous, I do give his side of the story, because whether it's true or not, it's important to understand what their view is and what they're trying to do by presenting this particular viewpoint on his ascension to the presidency, in that they want to make it so that it wasn't seem like a monarchical situation, that he wasn't succeeding the father, that there were institutions at work that brought him to power, and that maybe you know, by unexpectedly coming to power, it does buy him a bit of a grace period more than if he had been, you know, carefully groomed for the position. So there are all these reasons why he probably was giving that story to me, whether or not it's true. And I present all these possibilities in the book. There were some things, especially with regard to Israel and Lebanon. I mean, I asked him, you know, point blank, or were you behind the assassination of Hariri? And, you know, what's he going to say?
Sure.
Of course,
sure.
He's going to say no. But you look for, you know, his body language and his verbiage. And as I've come to know him, I've seen him enough times now where I think I can start to read that fairly accurately. And plus the way he extemporaneously answers, I mean, it's mostly just me and him. And he allowed me to record things, and then I transcribed them later. But the way he extemporaneously answered the questions, and nothing was off limits. But you have a sense of when things are kind of you know, the regime line, and then when things are really from his heart. And the more I talked with him, the more I think I could discern those things.
Well, now, you would expect him to be polite,
right?
But when he greets you very warmly. And appears to be a most charming person. Did that cause you to put your guard up just a little bit?
No, because I heard. I mean, he wasn't overly charming. He wasn't kind of obsequious or anything like that. But I'd heard from other people who had met him in and outside of the U.S. government that he was like this. So that was not a surprise. And again, I knew people who had grown up with him. And I knew something about his personality even before I met him. And so this all fit in with that. It wasn't different from the profile that I had constructed over the preceding years. So that really fit with that profile. And I think it is genuine. He is genuinely a nice guy. In fact, that's one of the problems, at least in the first few years he was in power, is that most people believed, even some within the Syrian government, who I shall not name, believe that he was too sweet of a guy. You know, he was too nice of a guy to mix in the rumble-tumble politics of Syria. But I think he's proven to be a little bit more, a little bit tougher than some people had expected. And there are signs of this in his past, too. But there were those questions in the beginning. But I don't think that takes away from his overall personality.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks
sure.
for the call. Let's go to someone else here. This is Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi. How thin is the Alawite-Shiite veneer in Syria? And it seems to me it's kind of odd that, is this a post-colonial circumstance in the same way that Iraq has had the Sunni rulers that the British picked? And we're already trading class. But it seems to me, why did a Shiite faction, which I gather is rather minuscule, actually, become the leaders in Syria?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's a rather interesting story. The Alawites comprise about maybe 11, 12%, 13% of the country, and the majority, about 75%, is Sunni Muslim, and then the rest are a mix of various Christian groups and other Islamic minorities. It is a result of the colonial era, and much as the Sunni class, as you mentioned, came to power in Iraq with British patronage. In Syria, during the Mandate years, when the French had the Syrian and Lebanese Mandate, the Alawites had traditionally been a very persecuted minority. They were very poor. Many Muslims, you know, mainstream Shiite as well as Sunni, don't consider the Alawites to be, in fact, Muslim. So they were kind of an outcast type of minority group in Syria, mostly in the northwest area of Syria along the coast. But during the Mandate period, the French attempted to build up an indigenous Syrian military force. But at the time, most felt that it was selling out or being co-opted if they entered into the military. And so the only ones that wanted to do so were the Alawites, and they thought it was the only way for social upward mobility, and so many of them joined the military when it was seen as an extension of the French, and so for nationalistic reasons, many Syrians didn't join, but the Alawites did, and then when the French left as a result of World War II, what did you have? You had an indigenous Syrian military that had many Alawite officers. And once the military became associated with the Ba'ath Party that was also rising in the early 1950s, this symbiotic relationship, quite serendipitously, brought the Alawites to power, and they've held the, you know, the they've had control of the military security apparatus really ever since the early 1960s.
It kind of explains the link to the non-Arab state of Iran too, I guess, with the Shiite connection.
Yeah, in a way, but that doesn't really play much of a factor because certainly the Alawite ruling class is very, very secularized. In fact, Bashar doesn't really consider himself an Alawite, and you know, I asked him, do you consider yourself a Muslim? And he said that it's more important just to be a good person and what's in the heart and all that sort of stuff. So it's a very, you know, secularized, and the Ba'ath Party philosophy is, you know, originally a socialist philosophy, although it's become mangled beyond recognition since its early days. That is something of a tie with Iran. It doesn't hurt, but mostly they've allied with Iran over the years, really since the late 1970s, because of their mutual differences and antagonisms toward Iraq, and because there are rival branches of the Ba'ath Party that had ruled in Baghdad and Damascus. And so whatever Syria could do to weaken Iraq was in their interest, and so they supported Iran in the Iran-Iraq War, and they supported the U.S.-led UN coalition in the Gulf War of 1991.
More contemporary question, then, if I could, is about the ties, and there was quite an opening to Syria, it seemed, the sharing of intelligence with the common enemy of the Islamists, mainly Sunni, to the extent that the U.S. was rendering, including this notorious case of Arar, the Canadian, mm-hmm. of Syrian right. extraction, that there was quite a bit of cooperation at the intelligence level. And I'm just wondering, I know what is the common place to say is, well, then Syria started cooperating with the insurgents, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So what
went wrong?
I think to my mind, it's probably, I'm asking a question more about internal Washington politics.
Yeah. Well, two things occurred, which I think soured U.S.-Syrian relations, which, as you rightly point out, you know, there was intelligence cooperation concerning al-Qaeda in the year or so after 9/11. It was important to the United States. On one hand, 9/11 really heightened Syria's exposure to U.S. foreign policy, especially as the latter shifted in the post 9/11 environment with the formulation of the Bush Doctrine of the global war against terrorism, certainly by, you know, September, the fall 2002. And the Bush administration started to cast a wide net on who they considered to be terrorists and expanded it from groups like al-Qaeda to groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. And those are two groups that, for quite different reasons, Syria supports to pad its interests in Lebanon with Hezbollah and with Hamas to give it some leverage vis-a-vis the Israelis. And the more that Syria supported those groups, unknowingly they were really getting on the wrong side of the global war on terrorism of the United States. And this is one area where, again, Bashar, I think, made a mistake in that he didn't adjust to these changes in U.S. foreign policy. He thought, and Damascus thought, the old rules of the game were still in place, you know, the traditional honey and vinegar relationship between Washington and Damascus. And what Damascus didn't realize was that the new rules of the game were being written in Washington due to the effects of 9/11. And then secondly, the Syrian support for the insurgents really turned off a great many people in the Bush administration and reinforced this already developing attitude that I just talked about. But from the Syrian perspective, again, as they did in Lebanon under his father, he thought that having 150,000 troops or so, American troops in Iraq, that was a threat. And there was a lot of bombastic statements made by Bush administration officials right after the initial phase of the war, like, you know, whether are we going to turn right and move on toward Iran or turn left and move on toward Syria. And there were lots of off-the-record remarks made to Syrian officials that Syria better be on guard. And so they really felt threatened. So again, as they did in Lebanon, they felt they had to do what they could to survive from their perspective, whether, you know, it's credible or not. And so they did start supporting the insurgents in Iraq, although, you know, after about a year or so, they started to rein that in. And you know, they have an interest now in a stable Iraq as well. But in the beginning, they did, because they wanted the United States to become bogged down. Now, having said that, If the border between Syria and Iraq was hermetically sealed, you'd still have you still have a lethal insurgency. In other words, Syrian support was always very marginal, I think, in the effectiveness of the insurgency. But now that the U.S. is clearly trying to get out of Syria, I think, Iraq, Syria feels much more comfortable about the situation and has dialed down its support of the insurgency.
We're going to have to stop there. My apologies. We have a caller we can't take. We've simply come to the end of the time. The book, if you'd like to read it, is The New Lion of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. It's published by the Yale University Press by our guest, David Lesh. He's professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio in Texas. Professor Lesh, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, originally broadcast on April 4th. Many past shows from Focus, also the Afternoon Magazine, a lot of other things as well available for you to listen to on our website. You can listen anytime you like. That's WILL.UIUC.EDU. Well, we know that folks like you understand that our listener support goal of $900,000 must be met by the end of this month, if we're to maintain the level of service that you expect from us. Right now, we are $122,800 short of the amount that we need. And we now hope that you will help us make a contribution to WILL and work to protect something that we know you value. You can do that in a couple of ways. You can send us a check. Mail it to UIF, Friends of WILL Radio. We're at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois. The zip code is 61801. You can call us, make a contribution that way, 217-244-9455. Or you can log on to our pledge site on the web, which is willpledge.org, and you can make your contribution that way. Whatever way you do it, we hope that you will, because there you're making an investment in the future of the service and will help us continue to maintain this level of quality that we know you expect and you rely on. And if you do make that contribution, when you do, we say thank you very much. That's it for us here on Focus 580. Tomorrow morning, just a quick mention that in the second hour, Larry Lister will be here once again. He's an engineer, works with a company called Facility Dynamics. It specializes in energy efficiency in the construction and operation of buildings, and in his professional work, thinks about really big buildings, but occasionally he's on the program and we talk about energy use and efficiency around the home. So that's what we'll be doing tomorrow morning in the second hour of the program. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We welcome your questions and comments. Right now, we want you to stay tuned because up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Gwynn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we are going to talk about gardening and heirloom seeds with Lynn Coulter. She's a gardener and a writer, and she is the author of Gardening with Heirloom Seeds, Tried and True Flowers, Fruits, and Vegetables for a New Generation. She'll join us at 1:06 Central Time. Let's take a look at commodity prices. Kansas July wheat trading at $4.71 in